I want to thank Rabbi Elefant for his very informative session. I'm sure there are many more questions, and hopefully at the end the Rabbi Lubens will agree to take even more questions. But it's now a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Yaakov Luban. Rabbi Luban is the executive rabbinic coordinator for OU Kosher. He's a Rav in Edison, New Jersey, also considered to be very much an expert in the field of kashrus and a great resource to people around the world and to the ORB down here in South Florida. We're very grateful for his wisdom, for his agreeing to be here to speak about an important topic. It's a topic I suspect the people who don't want to hear the answers to are not here to hear. And I'm going to guess that everyone here already is very careful with it. But nevertheless, it should be spoken about because it's important to be informed and educated in every which way. And hopefully that will seep out and spread to those who don't want to hear about it, to make sure that their dishes are not the only thing that go to Olam Haba, but that they go as well. So it's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Luban. On the topic of eating out, what could be the problem?
Thank you, Rabbi Goldberg. I'm here only a short time, and I heard very wonderful things about Rabbi Goldberg in the community. This is a very warm community, not only in terms of the weather. We're up north, it's about 10 degrees, and it's a pleasure to be here, but it's like a teaser to come here for 12 hours and have to go back to the snow and sleet and cold. I, by way of introduction, I want to tell you a story that happened to me maybe about 30 years ago when I first came to my shul in Edison, New Jersey. We had a pizza shop that was under our supervision, and I would inspect the pizza shop generally once a day, and there was another rev in town also went in on a daily basis. And it was Chol of Yisrael pizza shop. All the cheese was Chol of Yisrael. And I would go into the refrigerator area every day, and he had stacked to the ceiling, he had boxes of kosher cheese. So one day I came into the pizza shop, and I saw that I was doing my inspection, and I saw these number 10 cans, large cans, that did not have a label. And I was, you know, surprised that the can did not have a label. I thought maybe he took off the label because he didn't want me to see what was in the can. And I asked him, what's in the can? And he told me it's green beans. And I knew it wasn't green beans because embossed on the can, it said product of Spain, and people don't bring in green beans from Spain. So I asked him to open the can for me. He opened it up, and it was canned plums. Now, the truth is, canned plums probably does not need supervision, and if he would have left the label on, it would have been fine. But I was troubled because obviously he was trying to hide it from me. But I was even more troubled because you don't buy one can of plums. You buy a case. And I had gone through the entire facility. It wasn't a big place. I went through very carefully. And there were no other cans of plums. So he had, across the street, he had an office. And I asked to see I thought maybe he's keeping the other canned plums in the office. And who knows what else he has in his office. The office was across the street, and it was in a basement. So he took me to the office. We went down the stairwell, and under the stairwell were bags of garbage. And one of the best places to get, I'll tell you a secret of the trade, one of the best places to find out information is to look at the garbage. I don't usually do that, but I saw the bags of garbage, and I was just, sort of like snooping around. And when the fellow saw me looking at the garbage bags, he runs over to one of the bags, he grabs the bag, puts it on his shoulder, and he darts up the stairs. So he's running away with a bag of garbage. So what am I going to do? I run after him. And I come out of the basement, and he's already running down the street with a bag of garbage. I was a little bit younger then, so I was able to run almost as fast as he was. Had my hat on my head, keep my hat on, and my tzitzis were flying in the wind, and I'm chasing him down. It's too bad there was no movie crew there. Chasing him down the street with the bag of garbage. So finally, he darts. There was a truck there, so he darts behind the truck, and I caught up to him. He's stuffing the bag of garbage under the truck. And I pulled out the bag of garbage, and lo and behold, in the bag of garbage were empty boxes of hard cheese. And I don't remember the name, but it was obviously some type of non-kosher George's cheese or something that was not kosher. So he said to me, Rabbi, he says, these boxes are not mine. They've been in the basement for 10 years. I had nothing to do with them. Yeah, he's running away with the evidence. But I looked at the expiration date on the boxes, and they were like 6 months hence. So it was obvious that it was new product. So immediately we withdrew the supervision. And after much investigation and inquiry and discussion with the owner of the store, I didn't understand how he was bringing in non-kosher cheese into the store. And I did some research. I spoke to the supplier of the cheese, and the supplier told me that in the last year he had cut down, the owner had cut down his orders by 50%. So it was obvious what he was doing was he was buying kosher cheese and non-kosher cheese, and he was mixing the two together. He was saving $1,000 a month. This goes back 30 years ago by using non-kosher cheese. But how did he get the non-kosher cheese into the store? So in the end, he admitted to me what he did. He would come in at night, and the store was closed, and the blinds were down. And, you know, in a pizza shop, they have these tubs of cheese, and they don't grate the cheese. They have these huge blocks. When you order a pizza, they don't take the block and start grating the cheese. They have it available in the tubs. So he would come in at night, and he would grate cheese into the tubs. And in the morning, when I came into the store, so I saw all these tubs of cheese, of grated cheese, but I was unsuspecting. But really, it was a non-kosher cheese. And this person was, let's call him semi-Shomer Shabbos. He was quasi-Shomer Shabbos. He had some level. He used to attend shul. And I learned then that when it comes to cheese supervision, not only when it comes to meat, but even when it comes to an item like hard cheese, where the cost differential between kosher and non-kosher is very significant, one has to be extremely careful. Afterwards, he got angry at me, threatened to murder me. I had to go to the attorney general to ask for some police protection. But in any event, that was the story that happened to me. And I use this as an introduction. You know, Cy Sims, who spent about 35 years promoting his retail clothing store on TV, used to say, an educated consumer is our best customer. I'm not sure that that's true in the retail line of business, but it's certainly true for kosher consumers, that educated consumers are best suited to keep kosher. And that's what I'd like to do for a few moments this morning, to discuss with you things that you should be aware of about kosher supervision of restaurants and food service facilities. I want to preface what I'm saying with the comment that, Baruch Hashem, you have here some very outstanding hashkochos. But I had the opportunity, the OU has a program where if a community asks for an audit of their supervision, the OU provides resources that we go down and we do an audit for them. And I have personally traveled a lot of communities throughout the country, and I've sort of seen the spectrum of the level of supervision that is, and it's not an even one. And my entire message really could be summarized in two sentences, and that is that, number one, kosher supervision is very complicated, and number two, that there are supervisions that are reliable and there are supervisions that are not reliable, and then there's a lot in between, the entire spectrum in between, and that one has to be an informed consumer in order to properly keep kosher. On the one hand, industrial kosher is far more complicated than food service, because you're dealing with huge companies that can have 100 or 1,000 ingredients. The equipment is very sophisticated and complicated. Mashgiach has to be very well trained in order to even know what he's looking at, and there could be hundreds of miles of pipes that are twisted and turned all sorts of directions running through the facility. But on the other hand, a local establishment like a butcher shop or a bakery or a restaurant does not have that level of complexity, but there's a different challenge in supervising a local store, and that is that the control system oftentimes has to be much greater. In many instances, it's necessary to have a mashgiach tamidi, a full-time mashgiach, whereas in factories, generally, it depends on the factory, but many factories will visit on a regular basis, but we're not there full-time. And there's a number of reasons for that. One reason is because the cost differentials, I mentioned before, the difference between kosher cheese and non-kosher cheese is very, very significant. And of course, when it comes to kosher meat or kosher chicken, the cost differential is also very, very high, and therefore there's a tremendous incentive to purchase product that may not be 100% kosher. There's also, in a factory, they generally order ingredients in bulk. They don't order 5 pounds of a bakery mix. Whereas in a local restaurant or bakery, if they're short on 2 pounds of margarine, they'll send somebody out to the supermarket to purchase it. So therefore, you need much more control. And finally, there are certain things that have to be done in a restaurant that require intense supervision. There's issues of bishlakim, which I'll talk about in a moment, and bedikas toloim, inspection for infestation. And therefore, the level of control in a restaurant facility or a pizza shop or stores of that sort require much more intense supervision. So what determines whether a supervision is good or not good? Why is it that some hashkachas are better, some are not so good? In some yeshivas, they have this policy that they only allow products into the yeshiva if the Rav HaMachshir writes his name with Hebrew letters. And I that's like an astounding way of deciding whether any second grader knows how to sign his name with Hebrew letters. So that doesn't tell you very much about the quality of supervision. And people in general have a very naive perception of hashgacha, and they think, well, if there's a rabbi there, it's probably good. And I've spoken to even people who you would think would be knowledgeable, and they have this idea like, what's the big deal? As long as you have a rabbi there, it should be okay. And Rabbi Oliphant already told that the beautiful story about Rousseau Salanter. I was going to say that if you needed to do surgery, you wouldn't open up the telephone book and look down the names, and you see a Jewish name like Stern and say, oh, Stern, he sounds like a nice Jewish name, must be a good doctor. You would investigate and find out what his reputation is. And when it comes to kashrus, people oftentimes just rely on the fact that there's a rabbi there and they assume that's okay. So I want to discuss with you what are the various criteria or the elements that are involved in having a quality supervision. So the first is, what are the standards of the establishment? There's objective standards. Every establishment has to have objective standards. The standards are set by the Rav HaMachshir, the individual who's overseeing the hashgacha. The standards are not set by the mashgiach who's in place, but they're set by either an individual who's a Rav HaMachshir, or it could be an organization, who are the Rabbanim HaMachshirim. What are the standards for the establishment? I remember sitting with Mr. Berman when he chaired the Joint Kashrus Commission. We spent hours and hours discussing standards of OU facilities. So what are the standards that are in place? So what are some of the issues of standards? So one issue is, does the establishment have a mashgiach tamidi? And I've already sort of alluded to the fact that a meat establishment or an establishment that uses hard cheese, the OU will not supervise those type of establishments without a mashgiach tamidi. In some places, they'll have somebody come in and out on a regular basis, but it doesn't take much time for somebody to bring in a non-kosher product. We once had an OU restaurant. Rabbi Elephant, I'm sure, remembers the story. There was a Chinese restaurant, and the mashgiach was extremely astute, and he labeled everything to an extreme. Whatever was in the refrigerator didn't have a label on it. He went and put on his own label, and he signed his name. He was very much on top of the situation. But he was so careful that one day he came early to the store, and he went across the street and into a bank, and he was watching through the window. He was watching to see the arrival of the owner of the establishment. And lo and behold, the owner shows up with two shopping bags that he was carrying, and there was a stairwell right next to the restaurant. And the owner goes up the stairwell with the two shopping bags, and he comes down without the two shopping bags. So the mashgiach waited until the owner was no longer in the area. He went up the stairs and he saw that the two shopping bags had chicken cutlets. And I would imagine what the owner was planning to do was, when the mashgiach would turn around for a minute, he would go to the bathroom or something, he would have brought in the cutlets into the store. and the workers are very fast. They would have it breaded and frying right away, so there would be no evidence. So it doesn't take very long for somebody to bring in something non-kosher into a facility. So that's the first issue. Is there adequate hashgacha, and in many cases it's necessary to have hashgacha to meet this, in the facility? Even if it's a power facility where there's no meat and there's no dairy, there's a very good reason to have a mashgiach tmidi, because if the establishment cooks foods where there's an issue of bishul akum, then there's a question: how do you control that the food should not be that it should be bishul yisrael? Bishul akum means that foods that are not edible in a raw state the fire has to be turned on by a Jewish person, unless it's the type of food that you would normally not serve at a royal banquet. But something as simple as eggs. There's an issue of bishul akum on eggs, and therefore how do you control if there's no mashgiach in the store? So who's controlling that? The workers, usually the workers, you have a range of workers in the store. Who's controlling that a non-Jewish worker does not turn on the fire? So what many establishments do is they have the pilot light is lit by the mashgiach, and therefore they rely on the fact that the pilot light was lit by mashgiach. It's considered bishul yisrael. That happens to be a halachic dispute, whether if the pilot light, if you turn on a fire, if the pilot light was lit by a Jew and the pilot light ignites the main fire, does that constitute bishul yisrael? There is what to rely on. It's best that the mashgiach should turn on the fire himself. But in cases of difficulty, so one could rely on the fact that if the pilot light was lit by a Jew, so that would be adequate. The problem is that pilot lights tend to go out. They don't stay on forever. We have a facility in Edison where the pilot light always goes off, because whenever they open the door in the back of the store, the wind comes in and the pilot light goes out. You're cooking soup, the soup boils over, the pilot lights go out. So if you don't have a mashgiach there, how are you going to control the bishul akum? The OU policy is, if we have an establishment where there's a bishul akum issue, even if there's no meat and no dairy, we will have to have a mashgiach tmidi that's present. I went to a facility where there was no mashgiach, and the Rav HaMachshir would come in once a week, and he would light the pilot light, and he relied on that. He assumed that the pilot light would probably stay on for the rest of the week. So I said to him, pilot lights go out. So he says, he has a system. I said, okay, good. What's your system? He says, I took away the matches from the workers. How does he know? What does he do? He searches the workers every day when they come into the store. And then he said, and also I told them that if it goes out, they should call me. If the work, he's in the middle of there's 20 people in the store. They want to have their eggs. He's going to wait a half hour until the mashgiach comes from the other side of the town to light the fire. So that's another reason to have a mashgiach to meet. There's another issue, and Rabbi Elfin talked about it briefly, and that is bidikas toloim. The many vegetables and fruit have issues of infestation, and they have to be properly inspected. Some of the worst kashrus problems have to do with infestation, because if you eat one bug, there's five or six different violations and those are Yisurim Daraisa, those are biblical prohibitions. Many of the issues that we deal with are, there's an ingredient that it's possible that batel b'shishim, maybe there's a nullified in 60 parts, and it's this and that. But if you eat a whole bug, it's a very serious matter. So the vegetables have to be inspected properly. Halachically, a person who's not Jewish cannot be the one to do to check the vegetables, unless you have a mashgiach standing there watching what he's doing. But otherwise, it has to be done by a person who is a Torah observant Jew. So that requires to have a mashgiach present. So in some places, what they'll do is the mashgiach will come every other day, and he'll check the vegetables. And that way they have it prepared by a religious person. But the question is, what happens if they run out of vegetables? What's the control? How do they know? I mean, I've even been in places where I went into they had checked vegetables and non-checked vegetables in the refrigerator. So how in the world could you control the non-checked vegetables to know that they're not going to use them until they check? And then A related issue is what system of Bedikas Talayim? There are many different halachic positions about what requires Bedikas Talayim and how to check for infestation. That's another area of standards. A general question that comes up all the time is, can the owner be the mashgiach? You could do a study on this. Could the owner be, if the owner himself is Shomer Mitzvahs, if he doesn't observe kashrus, he's not, halachically he's not trustworthy, and practically he's not trustworthy, but if he himself is a observant Jew, can he serve as his own mashgiach? So the answer is, on a halachic level, he certainly could, because there's a principle in halacha, we all eat in each other's houses. How do we know that the person who invited us, how do we know that the food's kosher? Because they're Shomer Shabbos, so we rely on them that they're observing the laws of kashrus. But practically speaking, when you're dealing with food establishments where there's a lot of money involved and there's enormous pressure on people, at times, it doesn't happen often, but unfortunately at times, people make compromises. There was the well-known scandal in Muncie a few years ago. There was a butcher shop that was providing meat and chickens for years and years, and the owner of that establishment had a terrific reputation in the community. He was a Magid Shir and a Bal Kore and a president of the yeshiva, this and that. He was very highly respected. I don't know what happened to him. Something must have, he flipped out somehow or another. But he was selling non-kosher product for years and years. And the most important lesson that we took, and the level of hashgacha there was very minimal, because the Rabbi Machshir was relying on the owner. He's a frum guy. What's the question? He's a Hamish fellow, as they say. But the lesson is that when you're doing supervision, you always have to have controls. You can't rely on the fact that, Rabbi Belsky always says to me, he says that and when you're giving hashgacha, you can't rely on Shulchan Aruch. What he means to say is, you have to go above and beyond what it says in Shulchan Aruch. There are heterim, there's leniencies and this and that, but the purpose of hashgacha is to make it as close to foolproof as possible. There's no such thing as a foolproof hashgacha. It's impossible. But you want it to be as close, it should approach foolproof as much as possible. And to allow a person, even when he's Shomer Shabbos, to be his own mashgiach, it depends on this. Obviously, I don't want to malign anybody, and I'm not saying that this is not good. I'm bringing it to your attention that you have hashgachas where they will rely on the owner to be Shomer Shabbos. Of course, it depends who the person is and what type of character he has and how well the Rabbi Machshir knows the individual. So I'm leaving it sort of an open issue, but it's a question. Are you relying on the Mashgiach are you letting the Shomer Shabbos person be the Mashgiach? In particular, in many places, they'll have the Mashgiach, the owner will check vegetables. And that, I feel, is something that it's a bad idea, because to check Bedikas Talayim, vegetable inspection, is one of the most tedious jobs in the world. I could not do it myself. I would go crazy after 2 or 3 hours. You sit with the bags of lettuce or other types of vegetables, and you're just looking for the bugs and looking, and I couldn't do it. I don't have the patience for it. But there are many mashgichim that are outstanding, and they do a terrific job, and they deserve a tremendous amount of credit. But to expect the owner of the store to be the one that's doing the inspection for Talayim, And he's under pressure, and he's got to do this, he's got to run there, and he's got to make a deposit in the bank, he's got to go pick up stuff and make a delivery. He's not the right person to do bedikas talayim. Okay, I have a lot more things to talk about, but I'm not going to speak about everything. Another issue that comes up in restaurants is the wine. Mavushal or not mavushal? Do they allow not mavushal wine? The OU policy is we don't allow wine that doesn't have a mavushal status. That when wine is mavushal, then it if a non-Jew touches the wine, even if the bottle is open, it doesn't become non-kosher. The OU will not allow non-mavushal wine in OU restaurants, and that's because it's very difficult to control. You bring a bottle of wine to the table, even the mashgiach will bring it to the table, but you have waiters walking around, or you can have people sitting at the table, and some of them, people will bring in guests that are not necessarily Jewish. then if a non-Jew touches the wine, then it becomes not only an issue for the people sitting at the table, but it is an issue even in terms of the glasses. That you pour the wine into the glass, the wine could be not kosher, then the glass goes back to the kitchen, into the dishwasher, and there's not kosher wine in the glass. So the OU will not allow non-kosher wine in a restaurant. I know there are many places where they do, they have systems, but again, it's an issue that I'm making you aware of. I want to talk briefly about bakeries. The big issue in bakeries, one of the biggest issues, is dairy and parv. It's extremely difficult to control a dairy, parv, bakery. The OU, generally speaking, does not have dairy, parv bakeries unless there is a mashkiach tmidi. It's difficult to control because a bakery is a busy environment and most of the work takes place at 2 o'clock in the morning when the mashkiach is generally not there. In bakeries they bake everything on sheet pans. So they'll have dairy sheet pans if they do. If they have dairy and parv, so they have to have some way of identifying which sheet pans are dairy and which are parv. So they'll have dairy sheet pans and parv sheet pans. They'll spray paint the dairy ones blue and the parv ones red, or maybe they'll make one hole in one and two holes in the other. And it's very easy for the sheet pans to get mixed up. I've visited a lot of bakeries where they have dairy and parv, and almost every single time the sheet pans are mixed up. I make a point of looking to see what are the cheese danishes on and the dairy items. I'm always finding that the dairy is on the parv plant. It's not done intentionally, but it's a difficult environment. Then you have the workers; they're not themselves Torah observant people. They don't care that much about kosher. So they need a pan. They grab a pan. If the pan is here, you know, you could stack them in different places. And then what ends up happening also is the pans in the bakery is not like a hospital. It's not the cleanest environment in the world. And the pans are greasy, and they stack the pans. They can have a stack of 50 pans. And what happens if they put a parv pan on top of a dairy pan, and the dairy pan was just used before for cheese Danish, so the bottom of the pan is greasy with cheese residue, and then they put the parv pan on top of the cheese pan, and then they take the parv pan and they put it in the oven. In the oven, they bake challahs directly on the oven, on the floor of the other hearth, and here you have cheese on the oven, and they're putting challahs, and then you go home and you eat the challahs with fleishes. It's a very difficult situation to control. The other thing is, in a dairy parv bakery, it's very hard to control the ingredients, because if you have dairy ingredients, how do you know that they're not using the dairy ingredients in a parv product? I had a situation, and it's embarrassing to tell it to you, but I had a situation. We had a baker when I came to town, there was a dairy parv bakery, and we insisted he wanted to be under our supervision. We said it has to be all parv, so he changed over to parv, and he was under our supervision for quite some time. And then the establishment was sold to a new owner. And the new owner came to me after 2 or 3 days, and he said that one of the workers in the bakery wanted to know if they should continue to use milk powder. I said, "What? What milk powder?" He said, "Well, the fellow told them that they would always go across the street to the supermarket and buy milk powder, and they would use the soybean flour bags. They would when they were empty, they would fill it up with milk powder, and that they look almost identical." So they. So after that, I was a new owner already, but we were concerned that to control it. So we were doing lab tests on the bakery products to make sure that the integrity of the product was okay. I once came in a different bakery where I mentioned before that the mashkiach is usually not there when the business is in operation. I was at a wedding in Borough Park, and in Borough Park they have their own time schedule, and they have a mitzvah tanz at the end of a wedding at 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't understand how everybody could be up for a mitzvah tanz. I don't know, Rabbi Elfin, do they work in Borough Park? And I don't know. So at 2 o'clock they're having. So I got home 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'm up very late, but I'm usually not up at 4 o'clock in the morning. So I used that opportunity to go to the bakery to see what's doing. So I went to the bakery, and I couldn't get into the store. The store was locked. I was knocking, banging on the door. He didn't hear me. But then I saw the garbage sitting on the street, and there were boxes that they were disposing of, and one of the boxes was chocolate chips that said OUD. So I confronted the owner the next morning. He says, "I made a big mistake. I shouldn't have thrown out my garbage." Yeah, all right. It's a funny story, but it's not so funny, because the point is, it's very hard to control these types of things. And after that, he had chocolate chips that were Parv, and I dated the chocolate chips because I wanted to make sure that he wasn't refilling the box with the chocolate chips that were actually there. Okay, so that's it. I'm giving you like a smattering of some of the issues of standards that are relevant in food establishments. The next issue is, and Rabbi Elephant spoke about this also briefly, who's the owner? What's his history? What type of person he is? It's very difficult. If a person is dishonest, it's enormously difficult to control that type of individual. Another issue in terms of standards is, the OU's position is, we will not certify a caterer who has a kosher and non-kosher commissary, because the ease at which he could bring in non-kosher into the kosher establishment is far greater. If he himself makes non-kosher product, and again, the incentive, the amount of money that he could save if he would do that is very significant. So the OU that's a standard that the OU maintains. Okay, in addition to standards, the next issue is, how knowledgeable is the person who's giving the hechsher about kashrus? You have to, the person has to, kashrus, as I said before, it's a field of complexity, and just like in any area, a person has to be trained and they have to understand what they're doing. You can't just walk into a place and start supervising. I was very disheartened. I was recently, somebody in my congregation asked me about a certain hashgacha for Pesach on a hotel, and I called the Rav HaMachshir, and it turns out that this person is not a kashrus professional. They don't give a hechsher during the year on hotels. For Pesach, they decided they're going to give a hashgacha on hotels because it's it's good business, and they can go there with their whole family. So I started to talk to the person, and it happened to be, you know, it was a fine individual. I'm not criticizing the person, because he meant well, and he just didn't realize it. But he was not knowledgeable. He didn't know it. And by the end of the conversation, he himself said to me, you know, he says, maybe I shouldn't be giving this hashgacha. I mean, the simple thing that I asked him was, you wouldn't know this if you're not trained in a catering facility. So they have convection ovens. When the door of the convection oven is open, it shuts off the power. And as a result, even if the Mashgiach turns on the convection oven when they start operations in the morning, but if the non-Jewish workers take out food from the convection oven and they shut down the power, so then the Mashgiach has to, if it's left open for enough time to cool down, then the Mashgiach has to, when they close the door again, it's just going to go on by itself. The Mashgiach has to be there to turn on the oven, which is not very practical. So what we do in OU establishment is we put in a bypass. We have an electrician come in and do a bypass on whatever apparatus that shuts down the oven. We bypass it so that shouldn't happen. So I asked the person, I said, well, what's the story with the bypasses on the convection ovens? He had no idea what I was talking about. He didn't know it was such a thing. He didn't know that in hotels, much of the cooking is not done by fires. There's recirculating steam that comes off of a boiler system, and that steam oftentimes will go, if they have multiple kitchens, so it'll travel on pipes through a path, and it'll go from one system, one kitchen to the next, and halakhically, that steam, if the vessels that are being cooked, in other words, the way it works is that the kettle has a double wall, and the steam passes in between, so that steam has to be, it because halakhically has status not kosher, so it has to be drained. If you're using it in a kosher kitchen, you have to make sure that it's not coming from a non-kosher kitchen. I asked him, what's the story with the steam systems? Again, he didn't know what I was talking about. I'll tell you a related story. I once went to a factory with a person who was giving the hechsher for 30 years, and he was a very fine Talmud Chacham, very nice man, and they made bakery supplies. And I asked him, I said, do they make... Is it all parv? Is it parv and dairy? It makes a big difference in terms of the equipment. He says it's dairy and parv, but everything is made cold. There's no heat in the facility. I said, okay. So I walked into the plant, And I saw right away that the product was heated because the kettles were steam jacketed. I knew they had steam jackets because I saw the steam pipe leading into the kettle. So I said to the Rav HaMachshir, I said, "You told me that it's cold, but the kettles are steam jacketed." He didn't know what steam jacketed meant. He just didn't know what it meant. Not knowing what steam jacket is and giving a hechsher to a factory is like if you claim to be an expert in baseball but you never heard of a home run. He didn't know anything. He didn't know what a steam jacket kettle was. How could you give a hechsher on such a... So I took his hand and I said, "Here, feel the kettle." He saw it was hot. He was like stunned that the kettle was hot. I said afterwards, if he had tripped when he was doing inspection, bumped into the kettle, he would have found out that the kettles were steam jacketed. But okay, these are extreme examples, but it's not that uncommon. It's just important to know that the person who's giving the hechsher has to understand the business. He has to be properly trained. He has to be as astute and sophisticated. And the last element is that the mashgiach has to be a detective. Because, I mean, sometimes I speak to people and I ask them, "How do you know?" And they say, "Well, I trust the owner." There was a caterer in my area about 25 years ago that was the state, the Kosher Law Enforcement Agency, did an inspection, and they found that they were using non-kosher, something from a pig to wrap the hors d'oeuvres. So the Rav HaMachshir took away the hashgacha. The next day, there's a rabbi giving the hashgacha. And happened to be a fine individual, a well-known rabbi. I called him up. I said, "How come you're giving hashgacha?" They took away because they were using treif, and it wasn't just like some little mistake, you know. They were using chazer in the facility. So he said, "Well, I spoke to the owner, and he told me that it came in by accident." I said, "Well, how do you know?" "Yeah, I trust him." How could you trust somebody who was caught? Maybe it was a mistake. I don't know. But you know, you have to be a little bit, you know, you can't be so trusting. If I hear a mashgiach use the word trust, I lose trust in that person. Because kashrus, you have to be, you know, in general, a rabbi has to be dalek kafskus, and we have to give people benefit of the doubt, and that's what I always talk about in my drushes and shul. You have to be, you know, trusting of people, but not as a mashgiach. As a mashgiach, you got to be Sherlock Holmes, and you have to be suspicious of everybody. Maybe they're telling you a story that's not true. I'll just tell you one story about, and then I'll stop for questions. Rabbi Elfin was talking about Oreo cookies. When I first came to the OU, there was a company that was making cookies and cream ice cream. And in cookies and cream, what they do is they make the ice cream and then they blend into the ice cream cookie bits. So they were using kosher cookie bits. It was from a company called the Burry out of Elizabeth at that time. So everything was fine. So one day the owner of the company called me, if you can imagine it, in those days they didn't have email. So he called me up and he said to me, he wants to bring in Oreo cookies into the plant. I said, "Why?" He says, "Because they have a customer that wants to make Oreo cookies and cream ice cream." And I said, "Okay, but you're going to bring in Oreos?" He says, "It won't have an OU." I said, at that time Oreos was treif. It wasn't just treif. It was made, on the label it said that it had lard. So I said, "But you're going to have Oreo cookies and kosher cookies. How are we going to know that the Oreo cookies are going to go into the kosher product and not vice versa? That the Oreo cookies are not going to go into the... They're only going to be used in the treifer product." So he said, "Rabbi, you don't have to worry, because the Oreo cookies cost double or triple. It's a name brand. Why would we use Oreo cookies in the OU product? We're not going to... We wouldn't do that. We're only going to use the Oreos for this one brand that we have of Oreos cookies and cream ice cream." Okay, very good. About 6 months later, I got a call from a woman who often was talking about the consumers. She said that she found an Oreo cookie in her cookies and cream ice cream. It was a ShopRite brand or a Pathmark, something like that, and it had an Oreo cookie. It was made by this company. And you know, you could tell it was Oreo because it says on it Oreo. It was a good thing that it was right on the cookie. It was a cookie bit. It was enough of the cookie to tell it was an Oreo. So I went down to the company with one of my colleagues at the OU, and they said, it must be that maybe somebody, it's impossible. He said, maybe somebody was eating an Oreo cookie and he tossed it into a vat or something. You know, that's how the Oreo cookie. But you can't, just because they say that, you can't assume that that's the way it is. So I was there with Rabbi Greenblatt. So we went to Yankel Greenblatt. We said, "Do you have any Oreo cookies and cream? Do you have any cookies and cream ice cream with an OU in inventory. They said, yes. They said, where? They said, it's in the freezer area. So I said, well, I'd like 10 boxes. So they brought us 10 boxes of OU cookie, as I say, it was Pathmark OU cookies and cream ice cream. So we took the 10 boxes, we brought them to the laboratory, we turned on the hot water, and we melted all the boxes. Every single box had Oreo cookies in them. And all of a sudden, nobody wanted to talk to us. They knew they were in big trouble. Nobody would speak to us. So we spent about 3-4 hours trying to figure out what happened. Eventually, we pieced it together. They had purchased this product that they had, Oreos, cookies, and cream ice cream. They purchased the ingredients themselves. The distributor didn't purchase it. They purchased it. And they lost the contract. So they had $25,000 worth of Oreo cookies that they had to use for. So they held on to it for a short period of time. But then after a while, they saw it was going to be beyond the expiration date. So they felt they had no choice. They started using it in the kosher product. The end of the story happens to be that the OU immediately terminated supervision. And I mean, this is off on a different track, just to show you the strength of kosher supervision. The owner of the company called up in a panic. He called up Rabbi Ganak and he said, if you terminate the supervision on my company, I paid $25 million for this company 10 days ago. My company won't be worth 2 cents if you take away the OU supervision, because the almost all the products, or all the products in that company, were private labels. It means they didn't make anything in their own name brand. They made for various supermarkets. And all the supermarkets wanted to have the OU because an OU product sells better. So they said, you take away the OU, we're going to be out of business. So he said, I'm willing to fire my entire staff in order, or at least my management staff, the people that were responsible. He says, I didn't know anything about this. The people that were responsible for this deception, I'm willing to fire every single one of them, and if you give me back the supervision. So Rabbi Ganak, who's the head of the OU, agreed. And we also required that they should have a Mashkiach Tamidi for 2 years after that. We had a Mashkiach Tamidi in the plan. I'm sharing this story just to show you how that a Mashkiach has to be astute. Even if it's it's not a complicated plant, like an ice cream plant, but if it's a bakery or a butcher shop or a restaurant, the Mashkiach has to be somebody that's very that's sharp and is detective, and it doesn't take anything for granted, and always is double checking. So in the end, how do you know I've told you some of the different elements that go into making a hechsher good. So how do you, as consumers, how are you able to establish whether those elements are in place? Most of the time, it's by speaking to people that are knowledgeable and that are familiar with the individuals giving the hechsher. I mean, somebody in my community calls me about a hechsher out in Utah or someplace. So I speak to somebody that I know in that area that's familiar with the rabbi, and I checked what type of reputation he has. I mean, the OU, we've been in many, many different hechsherim, so we have a very strong knowledge of different hechsherim across the country and across the world. But you need to speak to somebody. If you're walking in the street someplace and you see a restaurant and you don't know who the rabbi is, just because there's a restaurant next to the OU that has a hashgacha of a certain rabbi, and I say who. The restaurant, he gave, I don't know if this is put in the restaurant, I didn't look at it carefully, I just saw it 2 days ago, but he gave a hashgacha next to the OU 10 years ago. It was a fleishig restaurant. There was no mashgiach at all in the restaurant, and so his hashgacha is a joke. He learned in a certain yeshiva, and he has a fancy title, and his certificate looks very, very convincing, and he has all sorts of approbations, but it didn't mean anything. So you have to know who the person is, what his reputation is, and that's the only way to establish whether it's reliable hashgacha. Okay, I'd be happy to entertain your questions. Yes?
Did you pull the rest of the story about Hebrew National? Because many ask about it. You know, it's like I learned a while ago that they'll just say it's not great, but it's not recommended. I mean, what's the
I'm not going to comment on other hashgachas. I mean, the OU does Hebrew National. Rabbi Elfin, we still do Hebrew National chickens?
No.
Oh, we stopped the years ago. It's a different hashgacha. I'm not going to comment on other hashgachas. Yes?
You have so many hashgachas out here. How do you know the difference?
You're exactly right. There's a kashrus magazine that has, every year he publishes one issue with all the kosher symbols. Right now, I think he's up to 1,100 different kosher symbols, and there is no way that you could know the difference. The only way you could decide is you call up a rabbi or a kashrus professional who's knowledgeable, and you ask them. That's the only way. That is the essence of my whole talk, that you can't tell just because it's a pretty symbol doesn't mean anything. You have to check with somebody knowledgeable. Yes. So what is your question? Your question is how could you give a hechsher to lettuce if they don't check every bag? Or is your question how can we rely on a sticker? So let's talk about both parts of the question. The first question was the company themselves have lettuce. Some lettuce is checked and some lettuce is not checked. And even the lettuce that they check, they don't check every bag, they only check some. Virtually all the hashgachos on vegetables that need supervision because of infestation, the hashgacha agency does not check every single bag. The hashgacha agency, what they do is they take samples, and they ensure that the company is buying it from a field. Every field's different. It depends on the climate, depends on the time of year, it depends where the location is. So they study it before the company invest and buy product from there to see at what level is the infestation. And then when the product comes into the facility, they have generally a washing system, and then the mashgiach takes samples. He can take 30 samples, 40 samples. And in halacha, there's a concept called miyachena matzli, that if the level of infestation is below a certain level, then you're not required to check it. These issues come up all the time. You keep on hearing about that somebody found infestation in blueberries or somebody found infestation in nuts. You could have a worm in nuts, but it's not something that's common. So you're not required, halachically, you're not required to check it. And even if there is a worm in the nut, if you ate it, it's what's called an oinus. You're not responsible for that because you're not required to check for it. So what they do is they check it and establish, based on the mashgiach who checks it, establishes that the level of infestation is below a certain level. If it's below a certain level, so then it's not necessary to check the other samples. As far as stickers, you're right. Stickers are not, we don't like stickers at the OU because you could put a sticker on anything. What we do require, if there's a OU, sometimes the company is not able to print the bags in time and they use stickers. If they use a sticker, we require that the sticker has to have certain basic information. It has to say OU, it also has to say the name of the company, and it has to say the name of the product. Because if it's just a generic OU, then they could take the sticker and they could put on anything they want. So I don't know, in your individual case, but that's the OU policy, yes. Oh, that's right. Yes, thank you. There's a lot of familiar faces in the audience, so it's nice to be here.
Especially for Pesach, I see a lot of stickers on different products. If it doesn't have the name of the product, then we cannot rely on it, or we should rely on it?
I don't want to make a statement for other hashgachos, but
I'm saying OU.
The OU, generally speaking, does not have stickers that don't say the name of the product. If Rabbi Elfin, does it ever come up that there'll be a... No.
So, any OU product, we typically don't allow stickers at all. If we will allow it, we'll have to say the name of the company, the name of the product, and all that.
Yeah, Rabbi Elfin's saying that, like I said before, if there is a sticker, it has to have the name of the product on it. If it doesn't have the name of the product, then you should call the OU office and let us know. It's probably not authorized. Yes? No, Gidulei Mayim also have to be checked. If there's infestation, even if it's Gidulei Mayim, they control it very well. They have hot houses, and it's not because it's drawing on water, but they have strong controls for the product. In Israel, they have, either they grow it in very controlled environments, or they have a mashgiach that probably they do both together. That checks it regularly. Okay, last question, yes. Go ahead. Okay, the last two. Go ahead.
I came in late, so this may have been answered already, and I apologize. So, my question is with regard to the movement about the ethical treatment of employees in kosher establishments. As you know, there's a large group that wants to have a certification of ethical treatment of employees, and the OU has been vehemently opposed to that. My question is why?
Rabbi Alfred, I'll let you answer that question. That's a political hotbed question.
It says in Pirkei Avos you're supposed to answer the first question first and the second question second, but I'll do the second question first. The OU is not vehemently opposed. Okay? That's absolutely... The OU is not vehemently opposed. That's incorrect. The question was that there's a movement that in kosher-certified establishments, employees be treated properly. And the question was, what is the OU's position regarding that? The OU's position is, of course, that everybody should be treated fairly. The OU, however, recognizes what are our strengths, what is our area of expertise, as you've heard this morning, and what is not our area of expertise. And our area of expertise, and we don't claim to have any expertise, in employer-employee relationships. But we, Baruch Hashem, live in a country that has laws and rules that we demand that all companies that we certify follow the law of the land. So therefore, if we will find a company that we're certifying is violating the law of the land, whether it's regarding employee treatment, whether it's regarding any other aspect of the law of the land, sanitation, cleanliness, we will remove our supervision. But we don't think that it's our place to make those determinations, given that that's not our area of expertise.
Okay, last question. Sometimes companies, they don't have the technology to print the U inside the O. They'll print the U and then the O. It doesn't hurt to call the office and double check whether that's okay, but it happens every now and then. All right, both Rabbi Elephant and I thank you for inviting us. I hope you'll invite us again so we can enjoy the warmth of your hospitality as well as the warm weather. Just invite us in the winter, not in the summer.
Thank you.